Today's guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston, knows about money, finances, the economy, but more than anything else, he knows about taxes. And we're going to talk about how we can make the most of the opportunity presented by our current financial catastrophe. Do the bailouts make sense? What could we do that would be smarter, more efficient, more effective, and that actually might work? In an article in this month's Mother Jones, Johnston writes, quote, "We are at last at a turning point. We have a chance to end the socialism for the rich that put us into this hole. How? By, in effect, reverse engineering the debacle. Rewriting tax laws and financial regulations has been the principal vehicle for turning government into a subsidy system for the deep-pocketed and the well-motivated. It can work in reverse as well. We can start by eliminating some of the most spectacular tax giveaways and move on to doable, efficient steps toward shoring up our biggest asset, not stocks, bonds, or houses, but people. Best of all, much of this won't cost a penny. In fact, it will raise billions for the big tasks ahead." So those are the words of today's guest, David K. Johnston, in the January-February issue of Mother Jones magazine. But before I bring him in, a few words about today's events. I received a stocking stuffer from my sister for Christmas 2007, a keychain digitally counting down the time until the day that Bush leaves office. On that Christmas morning, and by the way, let me mention, this is a sister who is a, not exactly an evangelical, but I believe she is born again, and who she and her husband had voted for Bush in 2000. But by the time 2007 came around, they were well, as you will, converted. And on that Christmas morning, that keychain stood at 388 days. And as I typed this last night, it stood at 0 days, 10 hours, 13 minutes, and 5.5 seconds. And I looked at it this morning, and it is just blinking. 0000. I've often railed against the horrors of the Bush administration that have played out in seemingly every sphere of our lives and actually on every continent in this planet. For whatever hope in history Obama represents, the excitement of his campaign, election, and inauguration are fueled by our revulsion at the consistent criminality and incompetence of the Bush years. The suffering and breakdowns have been abetted and made worse by the failures of others, including the Democrats, the press, regulatory agencies such as accounting firms and securities risk assessors, among others. I said before the 2004 election that if America reelected him, we could no longer talk about Bush's war or Bush's tax cuts. His sins would be ours. The inauguration of Barack Obama as president tells us we have turned the page. We have renounced our complicity with George Bush, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, and so many others, and we have chosen change. Now it is up to us to demand the best of our president, our representatives, and ourselves. Due to the scale of our multiple calamities, we may finally be ready to make meaningful changes to the business as usual that has sapped us of our capacity to make the most of our collective moment on this earth. Let us pledge our commitment to participate in the difficult and the demanding healing of our communities, our workplaces, our schools, our culture, our government, our environment, and our global society. We must be awake, we must be vigilant, we must be tireless, and we must not settle. Rebecca Solnit put it well in Sunday's LA Times, quote, "The coming era doesn't mean that anyone can quit being political. After all, Obama, who is merely impressive as an individual, is unstoppable as a phenomenon created out of the collective hopes and desires of the public, which must continue dreaming and prodding him forward to make the world we want to see." And it's interesting, I wrote that last night, and then watching the speech this morning, I certainly felt that he was actually echoing the same themes, that it is about our responsibility, that it is about us, and interestingly, if you recall, one of the biggest failures in my mind, in the mind of many of the Bush administration, in addition to all their actions, was that they never asked Americans to be responsible. They never asked Americans to sacrifice. They never asked Americans to own what needed to be done. And that is, I think, right at the center of what Obama is asking of us. And then as those of us on the progressive side know, any politician goes to Washington and the money has flowed through the campaign. The money will flow every day he's up there. The backs will be scratched back and forth. And it is up to us, as I've mentioned a few times, it is up to us to hold Obama's feet to the fire the way that union members and farmers and the people of America held FDR's feet to the fire. And only out of that will come the actions we want to see. David K. Johnston won a Pulitzer Prize for his innovative coverage of our tax system, retired this year as an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's the author of Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else, and Free Lunch, how the wealthiest Americans enrich themselves at government expenses and stick you with the bill. I love your subtitles. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Jerry.
Just to begin, I mean, obviously, this is a day that's not just about our interview, and it's not just about the bailouts, and it's not just about taxes. Some of your feelings, if you will, about today's inauguration, about if you saw it, if you've seen, you know, just as a person, as an American.
To someone of my age, I'm 60, this is an extraordinary event. Something virtually unimaginable if you grew up in a country, as I did, where every night the nightly news in the late 50s and the 60s was about black people peacefully trying to exercise their rights, being physically attacked, arrested, water hoses, dogs. The three young civil rights workers in Mississippi. On the other hand, I called my youngest daughter today, who's 18 years old, and said, well, so what did you think? And she said, oh, it was very interesting. I said, did you watch it all? And she said, I watched parts of it. And I said, what? And she said, I'll read it later. And I said, I'm Kate, the day will come when I'm long gone that your grandchildren will say, you know, Grandma Kate, what was it like? And she said, you know, Dad, this is a generational thing. To you, this is an enormous thing. To people of your age, this is an enormous thing they couldn't imagine would happen so quickly in their lifetimes. My generation, we expected this.
Hmm. Now, she means, now, it's interesting. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot into what we expected.
Yeah.
But she
but, and I said, you expected that Barack Obama would be elected president. She said, well, a woman, a black, someone who came from somewhere else, and that we would have some profound change. And I thought, wow, that's kind of amazing. I hope this does not mean that we have lots of young people who sort of assume this will now be everything is wonderful, because it won't be. Nothing that matters happens without struggle. But you know, when you and I were growing up, Terrence, there was a lot of talk about un-American activities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you said the wrong thing. And Los Angeles, I grew up partly in Orange County and the rest in Santa Cruz. That was a big sort of issue. I think the only thing you can say that's un-American is we can't solve this problem. We can't do anything about it. The whole idea of this country is that we do not need King George telling us what to do. We will determine our own destiny. And we started out and failed. The first American Republic failed, and it failed largely because of tax policy. The second American Republic, the one that we live in under the Constitution, has written down for us the purposes of our country. And the purposes of our country, we, the people, in order to form a more perfect union, society, promote justice, establish domestic tranquility, they live in a peaceful place, secure the common defense, to promote the commonwealth, not individual riches. A lot of people are going to get rich, but commonwealth, and to secure the blessings of liberty. And I thought the most important thing that Obama said this morning, and he said a lot of important things, was that, you know, you can't trade your freedom for expediency. The world is not a perfect place. It is a dangerous place. If you, the day that 9/11 towers occurred, I was in one of the airplanes that was flying towards New York and was overflown by Flight 11. And when we got home, my seventh child was there. She was then in high school. And she said, well, what does this mean? And I sat down and I said, what it means is that some people have pulled off a stunt. It is a vicious, awful event, but it has no military significance. They have no capacity to occupy one square inch of this country. Unfortunately, I think our leaders will try and treat this as a military act, which it is not. They have not read Osama bin Laden, who wants us to get into a war in the Middle East because he believes that it will destroy the United States. And I'm afraid we're going to take the bait. And I said, it means one other thing. We are not changing our lives. We're still going to go to Europe this summer on vacation. If we happen to be in a plane, if I fly all the time, Molly, if I'm on a plane and some idiot decides to blow it up and takes it down, you don't change your life. You do not give in to people. You do what you think is right. You try to make the world a better place, and you do not cower in fear. And I look back on that, Molly and I have talked about it several times. I somehow intuitively had this sense. The Bush people were going to stoke fear. They had every right to go assemble the armies of the world and go kill the guy who caused this. And we have thousands of years of legal history that we have the right to hunt him down. They didn't do that. And the mess that we're in today, in large part, derives from what happens when you elect the guy you'd like to have a beer with to be president instead of somebody who is qualified.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, by the way, one of the high-ranking officials in the British government came out a couple of days ago as he was retiring, as he was leaving office, and said the whole concept of war on terror was a mistake. And this is basically what we're talking about right now. I remember I did a show right after 9/11, and I had a RAND terrorism expert, and I had a sociologist, and I had a satirist. and I did. Paul Krasner, yeah. Philip Slater, and I believe I'm forgetting the name of the RAND expert that I had on. But my question to the RAND expert in the very straight part of the show was, I said, the thing that occurred to me as I walked along the beach today reflecting on what happened was, have we done everything in our power to make terrorists like Osama bin Laden pariahs in their society?
Right.
And isn't that what this tells us we must do a better job of? And it was interesting, this terrorism expert from RAND, not your normal,
the Air Force's think tank.
Progressive institution. There's a new book out, actually, that quite goes into what RAND has meant to this country. But he absolutely agreed. He said anything we do that doesn't involve a Marshall Plan, anything we do that doesn't involve showing our best face to the societies in which these people arise and treating them differently than we would treat him is going to lose. And but as you say in what you were saying, which I thought Obama was referring pretty closely to the words of Benjamin Franklin, which I'm not going to quote absolutely correctly, but any society that trades freedom for security will likely lose both. Exactly. So now it's interesting. Again, this is Terry McNally. This is Free Forum. This is KPFK. I'm talking with David K. Johnson. His newest book is Free Lunch: How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Sticky with the Bill. And a very up-to-the-date article in the January-February issue of Mother Jones called Fiscal Therapy. You referred to it, and it was going to be my first question, which is, you write, the preamble of the Constitution tells us the nation's reasons for being in 52 words that can be reduced to 6 principles. And I was going to say, let's talk about that, because I think on a day when Barack Obama, a constitutional law professor, in previous trade, puts his hand on the Bible and takes that oath that the Constitution is worth paying a little attention to.
Yes.
And you also say, and this is the part that I think I was going to ask, so how do you get those 6? But you just did that. But the other piece is, you say progress must begin with a return to the best of the values that created this second American Republic, the first one, the Articles of Confederation, having failed because of its weak principles on taxation and so on. That's a piece of history that I would like you to refresh us about right now.
Well, the original Articles of Confederation set up a government in which there was no national currency. There was no requirement that you be able to move goods and services freely between the states. So furniture manufacturers in Connecticut, feeling hurt by furniture manufacturers in New York or Massachusetts, would get a tariff passed to protect themselves. The government had no real way to raise money. It had no strong central thesis to it. And it was a commercial and individual failure. The Constitutional Convention grew out of an effort to fix the Articles of Confederation, and pretty quickly the leaders said, this thing doesn't work, we just got to start all over again. And significantly, the first power we grant Congress, remember the essential important ingredient of the American government is it derives its consent from the people. It's our government. We use it to achieve our purposes. We grant the power to the officials of the government. The first power we grant Congress, Article 1, Section 8. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, and imposts. That's how important it is. Now, at the time, there were suggestions that we should have a tax system that focuses on agriculture or on manufacturing. And the founding fathers understood how taxes had historically been used to reward the inside crowd and punish enemies. Sounded all like maybe what George Bush has been doing, what Ronald Reagan was doing, creating a system. In fact, you heard the Bushies openly say that the alternative minimum tax, well, it mostly hits the blue states. You know, I'm sorry, we're not blue and red states. We're America. The you will also, by the way, hear in the world out there, folks on the right who will say the whole tax system is unconstitutional because Congress has to collect the tax, not the IRS.
Right.
But the this principle that of finance is crucial. And you know, the founder of modern conservatism, Edmund Burke, in his famous 1793 letter wrote, "The revenue of the state is the state."
What does that mean?
The government's the money that it raises.
Ah.
That is it. That is really its measure of its power and its influence. And I'll tell you how important this is. The most conservative principle, I argue, in Western civilization is progressive taxation. It is older than this idea that's been heavily discussed, especially here in my home state of California in the last few months because of Proposition 8, that, you know, marriage is between one man and one woman. Well, 2,000 years ago, Jesus was asked what to do about the widow who had no children. And, Rabbi, what should we do here? And Jesus says, well, she should marry her husband, her late husband's brother. That was the custom then, if a woman had not had a child. And so that's plural marriage. Okay? It's in the New Testament. Now, let me go 500 years earlier than that. So
wait a minute. That's while she's still married, but it's just a
No, her husband has died. She's a
widow.
But
it's still called plural marriage just because it's another
because he already has a wife,
right.
So now he's going to have two wives.
Oh, it's because of his. Okay.
Yes, he's the one.
Right.
So this was a common custom. I mean, David had 300 wives and 300 concubines, and the Old Testament says the king shouldn't take too many, meaning so many women that other men can't have wives. Well, 500 years before this, in ancient Athens, where for 200 years they had debated and struggled with what to do about taxes. They had a flat tax. Every person paid the same tax. That was what seemed reasonable back then. You live in Athens in this beautiful place that has all the advantages of modern life at that point. Everyone paid the same tax. But for 80% of the people of Athens, this was a terrible burden to bear. And they eventually came up with a moral principle. There is no wealth without Athens. There is no wealth without civilization. If you build a house or a fortune or a ship to transport goods to make money, if there's no civilization, some thugs will come along with their swords, run you through, and just take it away from you. It is the rules of the civilization that protect your property and your rights that enable you to become wealthy. Therefore, the greater the wealth you are able to attain because you live in Athens, the greater the share of it you must pay back to Athens so that Athens will endure as a society and so that others are going to have the same opportunity you have. One of the things Obama talked about today was the world isn't just about you and me today. It's about enduring into the future.
Yeah.
Well, so what that means then is democracy is a byproduct of tax policy, because when they came to this moral insight, the greater your gain because you live in a civilization, the greater the share you are obligated to pay back to that civilization in taxes. They invented democracy. It's tax policy that gave us democracy.
And by democracy, you mean the ability of all citizens.
Well, their idea of democracy was much narrower than ours, but the idea is the king doesn't tell you what to do. The people govern themselves. Now, you know, we've expanded democracy in my lifetime. We've enfranchised blacks who were disenfranchised. We have not so many years ago, extended to women the right to vote. Men were persuaded over a long period of time by Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and a lot of others to extend the right to vote to women. Frederick Douglass and others were in the forefront of getting this country to end slavery, as an idea for which about 620,000 Americans and roughly 30,000 plus of them black Americans died in battle to bring about, to bring an end to. And I find one of the most fascinating things about America is that many of the people we call conservatives or who call themselves conservatives have absolutely no knowledge. They will tell you progressive taxation is a Marxist idea. It's in the second plank of the Communist Manifesto. Well, it is. But Adam Smith, you know, the father of modern market economics, he wrote in favor of progressive taxation. Karl Marx had yet to even become a gleam in his daddy's eye when Adam Smith wrote in favor of progressive taxation.
You've now put in a historical context the notion of taxation and the notion that progressive taxation is no new progressive idea. It's almost as old as democracy itself.
Well, it's what gave us democracy.
Right. So we've talked about the historical roots of this country and the historical roots of taxation and democracy itself. Let's move up closer to the present. You also write, since 2000, the median income of all Americans has actually slipped since 2000. And this was before the crisis, right? This was
right
before the crisis. Proof that tax cuts for the rich do not create general prosperity. So what you're saying is that in a time when there's been an awful lot of money made, people have been slipping because of what?
Well, what we've done is had 28 years since Ronald Reagan of supply-side economics. What we need are demand-side economics. That's the fundamental problem. We have concentrated so much wealth in the hands of so few people, far beyond their ability to consume. And for many of them, they're not business makers. They're not people who build businesses. They're investing in securities. So we have fueled this massive speculation and driving up of assets artificially in value by having low interest rates, abnormally low interest rates at the same time, and loose borrowing standards. We've created this ability for those at the very top to accumulate vast amounts of money. And those who got out of the market, and it's not most of them, a lot of them have seen their incomes fall back, were able to fundamentally alter things. You go back to 1980. The bottom 90% of Americans in 2006 made the same income they made in 1980.
The bottom 80%.
90%.
90%. So
right.
9 out of every 10
That's
people
right.
made
right.
hadn't increased a bit from
That's
80
right.
to 2000. 2000.
That
okay.
whole group
okay.
on average. Now,
however,
at the 99th percentile, there's a little bit of growth. But the real growth went on in the top 10th of 1%, 1 in 1,000. Back in 1980, the top 10th of 1% of Americans, that's roughly 300,000 people, they earned every 34th dollar in the country.
Okay.
By 2006, they were up to earning every ninth dollar. So the pie got bigger, and they got all of the bigger benefit of the pie. At the same time, their tax rates fell tremendously, so that their after-tax income was vastly higher, and we opened up all these new vehicles to allow you to collect today and pay taxes 5, 10, 15, 30 years into the future. A lot of what free lunch is about is all the taxes you pay. On top of this, there are all sorts of taxes you pay that don't go to the government but are legally given to the Walton family, Donald Trump, General Electric, Tyco.
PG&E.
That's right. And one of the things I write about here in Los Angeles, where I used to work for the LA Times, and people may recall my coverage of the police spying scandals in the early 80s and showing how the LAPD was not, as it was presented to be historically, the most honest, efficient, effective police department in the world, but an inefficient, ineffective place run by one guy who, frankly, very comfortable saying now, many of his top officers were busy telling me all the time how awful he was and incompetent he was. Here in Los Angeles, the rise of gangs, it's been a really big problem. When you and I were kids, we had gangs, but nothing like what we see now. The rise of gangs is intimately connected to a subsidy to one industry, and in particular, one company in that industry, which gets 40% of it nationwide, Tyco. the city of Los Angeles, between the years 1971 and 1981, experienced a doubling of the number of homicides. But it didn't increase the number of homicide teams, and I went into the LAPD's internal budget records and showed that on a budgetary basis, they had cut in half their commitment to solving each murder. And lo and behold, the unsolved murder rate went through the roof. And later, there were big series in the LA Times, after I left the LA Times, further exploring this issue.
Where does Tyco fit in?
Well, at the same time, the number of burglar alarms in the city tripled. And the city maintained a 100% commitment to answering burglar alarms, 99% of which are false. It's $50 at least every time, on average, the cops check out a burglar alarm. And at one point here in Los Angeles, every seventh or eighth call for service for black and white cars was to check out a burglar alarm, which was false. So the budgetary policy of the police department, they didn't even know they had done this until I wrote about it and explained their own budget to them on this, because nobody was thinking about it. I had to extract the data. They cut in half their commitment to murders while maintaining 100% commitment to false burglar alarms. Well, all across America, this problem continues. There have been some changes in some places to mitigate it. And in Los Angeles, you can track city spending per capita adjusted for inflation on children from the ages of 6 to 18 on recreation and after-school programs against city spending on the burglar alarm squad. And one goes down steadily and one goes up. And as those cross, youth crime takes off, so that the city back in 87, I quoted the city as saying that 75 parks in the city of L.A., and Free Lunch talks about this, were terrorized parks. They weren't safe. Gangs ran them. People couldn't send their children there. And I went around to these parks. I interviewed children. I was flabbergasted to meet kids who lived on the urban side, the downtown side of the Hollywood Hills, who didn't know that the Pacific Ocean was a long bus ride away, an hour or so to the beach, had no idea of that, had never been there. I mean, you grew up in Southern California, going to the beach if you're middle class is like a birthright. I interviewed kids, however, in South Central LA, near downtown, on the east side, in Pacoima and some places towards the valley. Boy, they could tell you gang neighborhoods. They could tell you this territory, you can't cross this street or that
we'll
one.
We'll take a brief break.
So one of the many things I've tried to show in my books is that there are all these things you don't see directly going on, and the rise of youth gangs and the subsidy to Tyco, where the police respond to the burglar alarm and the taxpayers pay the cost. And that's in their ads, if you watch it. In fact, the industry's changed its ads. They used to say the alarm goes off and the police are on their way. And when I pointed that out in my book, all those companies have now changed their ads. They now say the alarm goes off and help is on the way, to get you away from thinking about the subsidy that the company's getting from the taxpayers.
When you say Tyco owns, bought up all the many, many small burglar alarm companies, which of course gives them a little more muscle to have things the way they want.
40% of the market is now Tyco.
Right. And Tyco was, in case any of you have forgotten, one of the companies that was right up in the middle of the WorldCom, Adelphia, Enron mess in the early years of the Bush administration.
The late years of the Clinton administration.
Yeah, but I mean, as I say, one of the earliest failures before things really got bad. Let me look at the bigger level here. You write, interest in the federal government's debt this year will eat up the equivalent of all the income taxes we pay from January through sometime in May. Okay?
That's right.
Everyone hear that? That's paying just the interest on the federal government's debt. Now, where does the bailout figure in that? Was that statistic middle of May before we added the bailout? And then I'm going to ask you a second question, which is that, does that matter as much in the situation we're in now?
Okay. First of all, that number's pre-bailout. Half the federal government's debt, which is almost $11 trillion, was run up under the administration of George W. Bush. When Ronald Reagan was running for office in 1980, hometown boy here in L.A., what did Ronald Reagan say? Elect me to office and I will get government off your backs, I will reduce your taxes, and within 3 years I will balance the federal budget. He then went and ran these enormous deficits. The deficit in today's dollars when he took office was about $2.3 trillion. It's now $11 trillion before counting the bailout. Bloomberg News, and they're very good at this, Bloomberg News estimates that the investments, the spending, and the guarantees all together put us on the hook for as much as $8.4 trillion. Now, that's a meaningless number even to me, and I work with big numbers every day. So let me give it some meaning to you.
They're saying when you say on the hook, you mean in addition to that $11
trillion. That's correct.
This is what addition. You're saying is the bailout as of today,
right.
Bailout in the broadest terms, is over $8 trillion obligations?
Well, the $350 is already counted for, so it's about $8 trillion and $11 billion in federal debt. Here's how much $8.5 trillion is. It is all the income taxes paid by every American during the 8 years of the Bush administration, plus another $1 trillion. Now, remember those Bush tax cuts that were going to stimulate the economy and create jobs and growth? Well, during the Clinton years, we created about 22 million jobs. I haven't seen the final figures on the Bush administration, but I believe the final figure will come in around 5 million jobs or less.
Created?
Yes.
Even though we at one point had lost 2.5 million,
right.
And we've again lost.
It may be even lower
than
the number
I just said. We've again lost 2.5
million.
So twice we've lost.
It will be a tiny number.
Yeah.
And so that didn't work in that sense. We didn't create jobs. We didn't foster. We created a lot of jobs in China and India and the Cayman Islands, but we didn't create them here. The Bush tax cuts, which went overwhelmingly, and I'm the person who's written more than anybody else in America about documenting where the tax cuts went overwhelmingly to the very top, people with $100 million, multi-billion dollar annual incomes. And middle-class families who got the child tax credit, 100% financed with borrowed money. Basically, the government's the same thing as if you went down to the ATM machine and took out cash, and you pay interest on it forever. That's what Bush's administration did. They borrowed the tax cut money, and we all pay interest on it, and we get fewer government services. You know, we have cut education spending so much that the number of males in America getting advanced degrees has actually declined. If it were not for women, it would be a smaller number. When you then add in the number of additional degrees going to people who come here to study from elsewhere, it should alarm us that so many males in American society are not getting advanced degrees. We are burdening students with enormous debt. $85 billion a year lending industry. And students sign papers thinking they're going to pay a low interest rate, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7%. They didn't read their papers. The average return on equity of large banks is 17%. This is over a long period of time. The average return on equity for Sallie Mae, the biggest student lending organization, is 3 times that, 51%. There is no business in a market economy that can earn that kind of profit. And I would argue 17% is probably too high. It tells you there's not enough competition going on. But 51% is only possible through government rules that rig the market. So what we've done is taken education, which used to be free at public schools, and heavily, in fact, we used to pay people to go to school, like our competitors still do in Europe and Japan and Australia. And we've turned it into this business where we get these indentured scholars. And lots of young men look around, and they do not get advanced degrees. Well, guess what? The most valuable asset we have is the gray matter between the ears of young people that we need to develop, give rigor to, if we're going to endure and prosper. And this constant effort to turn higher education to a business is one of the many things impoverishing us.
Well, one of the other things it seems to me about that is when I think about young people, there are two different things that really strike me as affecting their perspective. One is the war on drugs, which to my mind says to so many young people, if you smoked marijuana, you're a criminal. And so, you know, just think about your relationship to your government or to authority, or if you're wise enough to know how silly that is, that you know your government's hypocritical. And then the other thing is, I think we want our people coming out of colleges educated and ambitious. And it seems to me that when they come out so saddled with debt that the risk they might take to try something innovative, the risk they might take to become an entrepreneur,
You've hit exactly upon the problem with this, that they become risk averse. They cannot, first of all, choose to go into public service careers and become nurses, teachers, librarians, police officers, with a good education because of the student debt. They are unlikely to go and take risk. And you know, I understand this. I went to college with money from the GI Bill because my dad was 100% disabled veteran. I had to go to work when I was 10 to help my parents and full time when I was 13. I then decided, stupidly perhaps, to get married when I was very young, and what it did was it made me very stable but very risk-averse. I bought a house, but I did not go into business and start a business till I was in my 50s, a real business. I stuck to a salary job, and I have looked back and thought, man, I probably would have done things very differently. And we need to think about young people. We want them to be able to, when they're young, take risks and try things, not just in business, but pursue an area of scientific inquiry that may be outside of what's accepted long enough to see if it'll work.
It strikes me that what we used to think, perhaps, is that someone who decided they would be an artist or something, you know, it sure helped if their parents had money. But I think in this particular setup, with so many kids coming out burdened with these huge debts, it almost means that if you're going to do anything of that's risky, it helps if your parents have money. And if they don't, you're probably not going to.
But what we really need to worry about, I think on another scale, Terry, is that it must be Mrs. Giuliani calling me. What we really need to worry about is that we're not... Sorry, that distracted me for a minute. What we really need to worry about in our society is that this is an example, the student loan business, of where we have used the tax system in the Reaganite era. We have used the government regulatory system as a socialist redistribution scheme up. The concept of trickle-down economics, a lot of young people don't know this, I'm discovering, by the way, is not something the Reaganites ever said. It was their critics. It was Democrats who said that about Reagan. Well, it isn't trickle-down. Trickle-down is the wrong concept. What the data show, and my work is all based on what's in the official government records, the data show it's redistribution up. It is Amazon up, not trickle-down. We make gifts of money to rich people beyond belief that I document in Free Lunch. Donald Trump. He tells everybody he's a multi-billionaire, right? Well, New Jersey is the only state in America that imposes a tax specifically for the poor. Donald Trump was given $89 million of that money.
$89 million?
$89 million. The big four commercial sports, baseball, basketball, hockey, and football. According to Forbes magazine, their operating profits are $1.6 billion. Now, that's not their net profit. That's operating. Net profit is probably below $1 billion. But let's take $1.6 billion operating profit. How much are their subsidies every year? $2 billion. So that means all the profits of the industries for baseball, basketball, football, and hockey come from the taxpayers. Now, individual teams may make money, but overall, the taxpayers for it. By the way, how did George Bush make his fortune? He made it off a
Texas
tax
Rangers.
Increase that was funneled into his pocket through the Texas Rangers. He not only didn't earn a penny in the marketplace, but our NBA former president wasn't even able to capture the entire subsidy. He left $38 million on the table. And the Bush White House agrees with all the facts that I'm telling you. They just don't agree with my interpretation of it.
Yes.
We have all of these devices that have been created that I expose in Free Lunch that take money out of the pockets of the poor, the middle class, and even the affluent. People like me. I've worked hard and I'm affluent. And give them to the super rich. And a few days ago, my 60th birthday, we had a party. And at the party were, because I'm often people say, well, you hate rich people. The LA Times, the New York Times reviewing my book ran a thing indicating I hate rich people. The net worth in my living room that afternoon was approaching $1 billion. I had at least three people in the room with $100 million fortunes. And they were reading poems to me about my writing about the rich. But the poems were all about understanding the difference between people who earn their money and those people who get it through these hidden government welfare programs by taking from those with less. And here we live in a country, well, the Constitution says there's no religious test for office. Politicians every day want to remind us that they are believers. Barack Obama demonstrated that today.
Well, on the other hand, I will say I people who've listened to the show for a long time probably know that I would cheer this moment, but he did say non-believers.
Yes, he did.
He did.
That was very unusual to mention that.
To say Christians, Jews, Muslims, right. Hindus, and non-believers.
But
the dominant
position taken of people who run for office in this country is I'm a believer. Well, here's a fascinating little thing. What is the number one thing where the word evil is applied in the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Quran? It is taking from the poor or those with less to give to the rich. In the Old Testament, in Jeremiah, it says, if you do this, your society will come to ruin. Yet our politicians enact these policies. Now, they're not doing it because they're hypocrites. They're doing it because they don't understand. They don't realize what they're doing. They have bought into our national narrative, and you turn on NPR, and you will hear the same narrative you will hear on Fox. And that narrative is, we must cut taxes to have prosperity. That the even Obama in his plan wants more tax cuts for business. That the road
he dropped riches, that, didn't he?
No. He's still got tax cuts. The road to riches is tax cuts, and this has become our secular religion. Well, I spent 7 weeks this last year doing research, traveling through Canada and Europe, 12 countries plus Canada, interviewing ordinary people about their finances. You know, in Sweden, the highest taxed country in the world, their taxes are 51% of their economy, almost double our tax burden. I couldn't find potholes. The cars were all shiny and new. There were, I counted 11 Cadillac Escalades in Stockholm that were gasoline's $11 a gallon. And I walked up to a dozen bus drivers at one point who were waiting for the tourists in Old Town. And every one of these bus drivers owned two houses.
Bus drivers.
And I said, how do you on a bus driver's salary afford two mortgages? And they all sort of smiled at me. And one finally said, a mortgage? I'm sorry, I own my house. Every one of them owned a city residence, mostly an apartment. A couple of them had houses. And then a country place. And the country places ranged from a glorified fishing shack with an outhouse to a big house with bedrooms for three generations to come and stay. People in Sweden are three times more likely than we are to own a boat. They're not in debt up to their eyeballs. Do some people have mortgages? Sure. Do some people have debt? Sure. But overall, they live better lives than we do. Now, the super rich do not live better lives. But 99% of them do.
Super rich of other countries, except perhaps Bahrain and the Emirates and so on. But you're saying the super rich in other countries don't live as well as our super rich.
Right.
But the rich, the middle class,
now, even the professional class, live better. I live in a neighborhood where a lot of my neighbors are doctors. I mean, I live in Rochester, New York now instead of LA. And, one of my neighbors, because houses are so cheap there, one of my neighbors owns his own jet. The doctors that are in my neighborhood, when I sit and talk to them in detail about their economics, and then I go sit and talk to a doctor in Holland about his or in Slovakia, hey, the guys in Europe are living better lives. They're under less stress. They're not doing all this paperwork. You know, we require doctors to do all of this intense cost accounting for every little procedure. Well, we don't require that of school teachers, police officers, anybody else. Why do we do it? Well, because there's a segment of the population that's getting rich off it.
Exactly.
And so we spend the highest amount of money in the world by far for health care. We have 47 or so million people with no health care. We have millions more with lousy health care. We have a society in which one of my sons who had a heart attack has been fighting just to get his bills paid. And they want him to pay out of his own pocket for the ambulance that took him from Hospital A, where they couldn't do open heart surgery, to the other hospital to save his life, and said, well, you should have driven.
Oh, God.
And why should you have to fight that? Nowhere else in the world do you have that kind of thing.
In your article in the current issue of Mother Jones, which you call fiscal therapy, you lay out a number of solutions.
Let's deal with the tax deferrals. Warren Buffett has a loan from the federal government that, since I first wrote about it, has grown to almost $670 billion. Million dollars. $670 million. Interest-free, and he has to pay half of it back 31 years from now. Now, think about that here in L.A. You bought a house in 78, and you hadn't made any payments on it all these years, and this year you got to pay half the dollars you agreed to in 78. You think that deal alone, Terrence, would make you quite well-to-do?
Well, for one thing that's in there is that all the inflation since I bought that house would have knocked my what I'm actually paying 31 years later down to almost nothing.
Down to nothing. You virtually would have gotten the house for free. Especially if you'd taken the money, if you had the cash for the house and set it aside, the interest on it would have covered it after all these years.
Because I didn't pay a cent, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, furthermore, if you're a hedge fund manager, until Congress made a minor change in the law prompted by, I think, arguably my reporting, hedge fund managers, you heard in the big fight a year or two ago, were paying 15% interest. Well, no, only those who took the money were paying a 15% tax rate.
If they deferred it, or as much as they deferred,
as
right?
As much as they
deferred. So they could take enough to live on and defer
right.
the rest.
That's right. So as much as they deferred, they paid zero. So we had five.
And let me just ask. Yeah. In their case, unlike Warren Buffett's, who would have to pay some of it 31 years later, they paid zero ever?
No. In theory, they would ultimately have to pay it. Here's the problem. A, would the government be around to check the records and enforce the law because your records are really in the Cayman Islands? Secondly, you could have used the money to buy life insurance, put it in a trust, had it paid out to your heirs, and then it would be tax-free proceeds for which you'd get a deduction when you took it because it's being held in the business. But the fundamental principle is this. I'm only allowed, as someone 60 years old, to save $22,000 without paying taxes on it.
Right. If that's how much you can put in your
401k.
Your IRA, your 401k,
right.
et cetera.
If you're an employer who doesn't have the plan, you can only save $5,000 or $6,000, depending on your age. But if you're a senior executive, a movie star, a big athlete, you're allowed to save unlimited amounts of money. Back in 1996, I revealed how the head of the Coca-Cola company had built a billion-dollar fortune without paying a penny in taxes, and members of his own board didn't realize what had happened until the story ran. It caused a lot of trouble at the board of Coca-Cola. If we stop deferrals, if we said, what you're doing in the deferral is you're loaning the money to your employer. Well, if you were paid $100 million and you want to loan it to your employer because you don't need it, you go right ahead. I don't want to stop you from doing that. It's a free market. But you got to pay your taxes first.
Before you can loan it.
That's right. None of this. I'll loan you the pre-tax amount. You'll pay me the interest on the pre-tax amount. And somewhere down the road, years from now, we'll pay the taxes. Uh-uh. My taxes come out of my paycheck. They come out of your paycheck. They come out of everybody else's paycheck before they get their money. Well, we need to have an equal standard here. What we have in America now are two standards of taxation. One for those people who are wage earners, and one group who are business owners, investors, and landlords. They are not checked up on by the government. They're not verified. The government trusts them.
Okay. One of your first solutions is just change those laws on deferrals.
That's right.
That everyone should pay taxes. And if they're very...
Pay
them now. And if they're very wealthy, good for them. And they get to do whatever they want. But they pay taxes just like everybody else.
That's right.
And how much would that make us?
We don't know because the government hasn't collected deferral data, even on the 401k deferrals. But if we made everybody pay up who has already deferred... And we stopped it, we at least get a one-time bite, I'm certain, of over $100 billion of revenue.
Right. Now, would I be giving up the amount that I defer?
Not if it's in your 401k? No.
So we'd let even the rich have a 401k?
That's right.
Right. Okay. What else? Another thing. Now, it's interesting that what you're saying is we are in this terrible situation right now, and there's no denying that. But what you're saying is that there are many, many things we could do simply through tax regulation. How quickly would tax regulation help us?
Well, there are a lot of things we can do. Taxes take time, and you've got to adjust the system. But let me suggest a couple of things we could do immediately. If you lose your job, you get very short-term unemployment benefits in this country. You'll get, in most cases, less than minimum wage. And so one of the things we could do is, we have surtaxes sometimes. You pay an extra tax. Well, let's have a sur benefit for the unemployed. Since most people are out of work right now, are out of work because there are no jobs to be had. It's not like they're slackers. Let's increase the unemployment benefit immediately by 30, 50, 100%. That puts money people will surely spend into the economy. It gets people away from looking for other government services. It reduces the demand on food banks. I wrote a piece for the New York Times earlier this year showing that demand at food pantries was up 20 to 40% depending on the economy in various parts of the country. That's a thing we could do immediately. Another thing we could do is 30% of grant requests to the National Institutes of Health, medical research requests, were rated by the peer panels as top-grade projects that should be funded. But only a third of them, only 10% of the projects are being funded. We're falling behind technologically with the rest of the world. Forget about the stupid rules about limiting stem cell research. And I say stupid because we shouldn't be telling scientists what they can do in terms of in the lab. Let's go back to these applicants and say, gee, are you still ready to go with your project on how to cure this disease, how to ameliorate this problem, how to investigate this syndrome? And if you certify that you are, checks in the mail. We're going to start funding you. That would put people to work all over the place.
So what you're saying is these are things that need government funding and actually qualified for it, but we didn't give it all to them. What
already
you're saying
qualified.
is given the situation we're in right now, where we're throwing money at bad debts of banks and so on, and we're looking at things to do with stimulus. You're saying there's one that will put people to work, and these are not. My guess is that grant money is not going to the super wealthy.
No,
it's going to academics.
It's going to graduate students,
yeah,
and lab rats and biologists and clerks, an enormous number of clerks.
It's
going to
help some of those students pay off their college debt.
That's exactly right. And let's stop bailing out Goldman Sachs. By the way, the whole bailout plan has been heavily designed to bail out Goldman Sachs counterparties. The Steelworkers Union had an analysis done, which I've checked and find to be credible, that the amount we paid for the taxpayers' investment in Goldman Sachs, because we bought some warrants from them, versus what Warren Buffett paid, we paid $5 billion too much. Now, the steelworkers call it a gift. I'm a little more charitable. I would call it bad pricing. But why are we investing in Goldman Sachs? They're a competitive, privately held business. If they took too many risks, they should go out of business. If I take too many risks in my little business that I run with one of my sons, we should go out of business. There's nothing wrong with going out of business. You cannot artificially prop up these artificially inflated assets forever. They must fall. The pain is going to be terrible. But let's address the problem. You know, we could have bought all the subprime mortgages in America for about $500 billion.
Really?
Yes. And they're not all going to fail. We're going to have a huge problem in 2010 when what are called the Alt-A mortgages. That's
yes.
the one where you
yes.
didn't pay the full amount. The liar's loans, they are twice as big.
Right, right.
They're going to come due.
And they don't come due until 2010?
Well, the biggest number of them.
Yeah,
if you look at the curve.
Because by the way, if people don't know what he's talking about there, it's that, we're going to probably end on this comment, that everyone talked about the subprime. But the thing is, people who got gimmicky loans where you had no interest or very, very low interest, and then you were going to suddenly revert to something much higher, those have yet to hit the fan in big numbers. And when they do, it's much bigger than subprimes. Think about it. Every time you opened your browser, you were offered a refi.
Right.
You got calls for refis once a week, and people took advantage of them because the bubble was never going to end. I think we got to wrap this up. Let me tell people, you've been listening to the words of David K. Johnston. He, as you can tell, he does his homework and then offers it to you. And the latest book just came out in paperback. It's called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expenses, Stick You with the Bill. And it will make you furious, but it will also make you smarter. And there is a website called freelunchthebook.com if you want to check it out. Thank you, David K. Johnston. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terry.